Gillian Strain, and welcome to the Go Health Podcast. So we are in season two of the podcast where we are exploring learning to heal, and it's got a clever double meaning. In this podcast, we are exploring how by listening to the stories and experiences of others, we might learn to heal ourselves, or we might be learning to be a source of healing for others. And we're in the final episode of the season. I can't believe it, but we are going out on a really high note with this next guest, the very Reverend Adrian Newman. Bishop Newman worked as a management economist before ministerial training in Bristol. He was ordained in 1985. He then served as a curacy at St. Mark's Forest Gate and then went on to be a vicar in Sheffield. In 1996, he became the rector of St. Martin in the Bullring in Birmingham. That's a church right in the middle of the shopping centre now. But he was there when it was getting built. He oversaw the redevelopment of the church site when the whole parish was being demolished and rebuilt all around it. He then became Dean of Rochester Cathedral in 2005 before being consecrated as the Bishop of Stepney in London in July 2011. At the end of 2018, he resigned his role on health grounds to see if taking some time out of ministry would help with chronic migraines and a period of mental ill health. And he then took early retirement in 2020. So I was working in the Diocese of London when I heard about this highly successful, highly talented bishop stepping back from a high-profile ministry and very openly talking about his health struggles. And I just knew that he was someone who we at Go Health could learn from. I knew he'd have an interesting story, and I wasn't wrong. It was a great privilege to talk to Bishop Adrian about his life, about his health struggles, and about how he lives and works and is today. The conversation was, you know, it was remarkably open and engaging. And really, it's worth listening to this episode. It's a wonderfully wise closing act of season two on the Go Health podcast. So please enjoy it and let us know what you think. Pop over to the Go Health community Facebook group. So on with the episode.
So, Adrian, thank you so much for giving us your time to come and chat on the Go Health podcast.
It's great to be here.
Thanks so much. So how are you today? Where are you sitting? How's your day going?
Well, I'm sitting in our tiny little cottage in the wilds of the Essex countryside. It's a bit cloudy outside, a bit windy, but having a good day.
Good. And, you know, we have been wanting to invite you on our podcast since it began, because you were in the headlines for stepping down from a senior role in the Church of England because of a health condition. And we run a charity all about health and faith, so we just knew we wanted to chat to you to learn from your experience. Before we get there, it would be great to hear a bit about your story, sort of pre-early retirement, how you came to be ordained in the Church of England, where your sense of vocation came from, and a little bit about your life before you got to that point.
So none of my early life was spent in or around the life of the church. It was all very new to me. And I suppose I had a classic Christian conversion in some ways. I at the age of 12 or 13, I witnessed two fatal car crashes in quick succession, in one of which I actually, you know, the two people bled to death in front of my eyes, and I was powerless to do anything to help. I was the first person on the scene. Those two quite traumatic experiences had quite an impact upon me, and I think led me, even at that tender age, to ask lots of questions about life. And I'm the youngest of six children, and my next sister up at the time had just started going to a local church. I think because there was a rather good-looking Californian bloke there who went there. But you know, she was that sort of awkward age for girls, sort of 14, 15. And I felt she changed for the better. I saw a positive change in her. So I went along and I just sat at the back of this church for about a year listening to what they were saying. And at the end of that year, I think I was convinced that there was something in it. And I vividly remember one Sunday evening in church, the vicar gave the classic altar call from the front of the church, and it was quite a packed church. There's about 400 or 500 people in the church at the time, and he asked people to come up to the front if they wanted to commit their life to Christ. And I, along with an ancient man who was probably only about my age, to be honest, but seemed like an ancient man at the time, and a member of the choir, the three of us went to the front. And that was the point at which I think I can trace my first sort of steps of positively calling myself a Christian to that.
What a thing to witness, I guess, at that age. And, you know, I wonder, do you think that's something that you've processed? Or I guess I wonder if other people listening to this podcast might have had similar experiences. Can you say something about how you've processed that and in some ways then reconciled that with this next experience you have of meeting a church community and learning about a God that loves you and presumably loved that person who bled to death?
Yes, I suppose it's a lifetime of processing something like that, although I think every experience gets caught up into further experiences, doesn't it? It undoubtedly was a shocking thing to go through at that age. I was very young at the time, but I think it probably simply exposed the fact that I, even from a young age, had thought quite deeply about life and felt that there had to be some answers around to the mystery of human existence. And that may sound too grand a thing to be saying when you're 12 or 13 years old, but I do think that even at a young age, I think people can feel that. And I was certainly somebody who was asking all sorts of quite deep questions from when I was young. But processing it, I guess one of the things that life teaches you is that pain and suffering and death and loss are part of the fabric of life. And if we're going to have a philosophy, if we're going to have a theology which takes life seriously, then it has to be capable of coping with the difficult and the dark elements of our lives, as well as, you know, when everything's plain sailing.
Yeah, we're going to get there. But
yeah, we will get to that, I'm sure.
Well, you are. We've only got to age 14. So you joined the church at that point. You gave your life to Christ, or whichever language you want to use around that.
Yeah.
So are you into vocation and training? What was that like?
From that point, I started going along to a church. And when I left school at the age of 17, I went to live and work for a year in a hostel for homeless men in Leicester. And that, again, was a very profound, eye-opening experience. Here was this rather cosseted, protected, middle-class lad with a nice sort of education and a middle-class family. And I went into a type of context which was foreign to me and not one that I knew at all. And I experienced things there which, again, were foreign to me and different and other, and helped me understand that it's a very, very big and complex and confusing world that we live in. I then, after that year, I went to university down in Bristol, studied economics. My dad was a businessman, ran his own business. He was in life insurance, and I think he had been hoping, and I think I had rather been expecting, I would simply follow in his footsteps and probably take over the family business at some stage. So I did an economics degree. And at the end of that, I went to work in the industry as a statistical economist for a couple of years. And it was during that period when people within the church started saying to me, you should think about ordination. And I was only in my early mid-20s. I was far too young, really. And so I sort of laughed in their face and said, well, I'll go and see the DDO or whoever it is you have to go and see. But I'm sure they'll just say to me, come back in a few years' time when you've got a bit more experience under your belt. But actually, the door swung open in front of me with some alacrity, and so I found myself training for ministry down in Bristol at the age of 23, 24, something like that. He was really quite young.
Statistical economist.
Yes.
So, as you know, I'm a physicist, and people who don't know much about science or the church will say to me, how can you be a physicist and a priest? Aren't they in opposition? And then I roll my eyes inwardly. I would never do outwardly, and then explain why they, you know, they go together so nicely. But I feel I need to ask this question, mostly because I'm scared of economics. But is there any crossover in your early life, in your training, that's useful for being a priest or somebody who is qualified to speak about God in some way? Is there any sort of crossover there? I'm curious.
Well, there were undoubtedly things about my economics and business training which proved immensely useful as I moved through different ministry roles. But undoubtedly, those experiences of economics and business were helpful. But I think, I suppose, the other way, anybody who's had any experience out there in the real world, another phrase I don't particularly like, but yeah, anybody who's had any experience of working alongside people in a classic working environment has got to begin to work out how and where God relates to people and people can relate to God in that ordinary and everyday setting. We've got rather good at just sort of closeting God out into the church somewhere, and that can all be rather comfy and easy, whereas actually it's the world in which God is, and we have to understand where we discern and see him at work there.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. Okay, so after ordination, you've served in quite a few, you've very good parish experience before being a bishop. How useful that must be.
Well, I mean, I suppose I'm one of those who believes classically that anybody who moves into senior leadership in the church should, as far as possible, do that via the parish route, because I think that's where you really do see the church at a grassroots level. So, I mean, I was immensely grateful for the parishes that I served in. Started off in the East End of London as a curate in Forest Gate, and that was a fabulous place to be. And then I went up to Sheffield, to an outer estate, very different. So London, East London in the mid-80s, was highly cosmopolitan, incredibly multicultural. I went up to work on a white working class estate in Sheffield, which again was very different. And of course, those white working class estates are now very much in the news at the moment, because they are the sorts of places where the church has been probably at its worst in terms of its visibility and presence and ability to serve. So, and then from there, I went down to be rector of a city centre church, St Martin in the Bullring. I'll always look back to my experience there as, you know, when I'm rocking in my rocking chair. I think that will probably be among the highlights of my life. I think working with a fabulous group of people to an extraordinary timetable to try and transform and turn around a church which was at the centre of the largest building site in Europe at the time. And
wow. Yes.
So that was a great experience. And again, broadened my understanding of God and the world in fantastic ways. And then I woke up one morning, one Saturday morning, day off, came downstairs in my pyjamas, and there was a letter from Tony Blair on the doorstep saying, I thought very carefully, I would like you to be the next Dean of Rochester. I thought, well, yes, I'm sure that's how it works. And I had been a great critic of cathedrals as a parish priest, you know, sort of distant and not properly engaged with real life, slightly elitist, went to Rochester Cathedral and was blown away by the way in which God was at work in a place like a cathedral. But that sort of broadened me out, certainly in terms of my ecclesiology, in terms of my tradition. It was a liberal Catholic setting, and I came to value the sacraments and mystery hugely from my time in Rochester. And then Richard Chartres, who I knew through the church commissioners, I was serving as a church commissioner at the time, he stopped me in church house one day and said, Adrian, could I persuade you to think about coming to London to Stepney? And that's how I ended up as the bishop of Stepney, almost back to my East End roots in some way, from my curacy.
Yeah. Well, you paint a great picture. A letter from Tony Blair in your pajamas, Bishop of London in a corridor. That's how it really works.
Yeah, it doesn't these days.
So before we get on to you being a bishop, we have a quite a high number of clergy who listen to this podcast. We run a project called the Healthy Healing Heart Project, which helps churches and indeed cathedrals. We've just had our first cathedral, in fact, be hubs for healing for the whole community. So promoting the healing ministry. And, you know, it's not rocket science. It's straight back to what Jesus said, make disciples and heal. So helping people do that with confidence in their context. But a lot of my time I spend speaking to really rather fed up, sometimes quite depressed, certainly disillusioned clergy, parish clergy who are on the ground. I know the church context has changed a wee bitty since you were engaged with parish ministry and cathedral ministry and things. But I wonder if you could offer some stories or insights about what helps when it's really tough. I know lots of people are on their knees at the moment, actually, with doing parish ministry as we come out of the pandemic. And we all know how tough it's been. Mm. So looking back, are there things you might want to pick up or highlight to any clergy or indeed lay leaders who are listening?
I suppose, what can I say to that? "'Twas ever thus," it is probably the last thing that people might want to hear. But I was interviewing some potential ordinands for the Diocese of Chelmsford recently, and I asked them a question at the end of this interview, which I was asked when I was being seen by the Bishop of Barking back in the early 1980s. And he said to me, "Things are pretty bad at the moment. Are you optimistic for the future of the Church of England?" And I asked the same question of people who were wanting to come into the church. And I suppose the point there is that's 40 years ago I was asked that question, and the Bishop of Barking at the time thought that it was pretty bad and pretty demoralizing, and that circumstances around us were difficult. So 'twas ever thus is an element of the answer to this, that there are always difficult and challenging circumstances to face in the life of the church. We have to believe in the power of vocation and in the presence of God within this, and not to get too hung up on some of the very difficult human dimensions to all of this. I suppose what helps, one of the things that I had to really hold on to carefully and consistently after my own illness caused me to step back, was to understand my illness as a gift and to resist becoming a victim. I mean, I was influenced by people like Edith Eger, the great sort of Jewish writer, who had refused, despite being a Holocaust survivor, to define herself as a victim, and has gone on as a psychologist to explain how important it is not to victimize ourselves. So I suppose there is something in all of this about how we retain our spiritual equilibrium in the face of enormous external challenges. How do you retain a balanced interior spiritual core to all of this?
That's what we're all wanting, that kind of balance as Christians, keep that balance, you know, as we progressed through life. So let's go back on the chronology. It'd be really good to hear a little bit about what it was like to be a bishop in the Church of England, the challenges of that, and then maybe talk about your illness and when you first started noticing it and having an impact on your work.
Yeah, well, I mean, being a bishop in the Church of England, I mean, it's I do think it's a very challenging time for anybody to be a serving bishop in the Church of England. There are lots of external challenges, but there is also huge expectation in terms of what you are able to achieve, and people will project all manner of unrealistic expectations onto you. When I was consecrated, on the eve of your consecration as a bishop, you get an hour and a half with the Archbishop of Canterbury, and Rowan Williams was the Archbishop when I was consecrated. I asked him in the course of this hour and a half, I said, "What advice would you give me for when I become a bishop?" I'd been a dean, so I'd been in senior leadership. I sort of understood some of the dynamics, but I still wanted to know what his advice would be about being a bishop. And he leaned back in his chair and he came out with something which was is ever old and ever young in some ways. He said, when you become a bishop, you will be praised for all manner of things you deserve no praise for, and you will be blamed for all manner of things you deserve no blame for. You have to learn to treat those two impostors both the same. So, you know, you can be seduced by the position of being a bishop. There's no doubt about that. You have to resist being seduced by it, seduced by the way in which people can say things about you which are wholly unrealistic, you know, positive things about you which are wholly unrealistic and don't reflect who you are at all. But you also need to resist being completely demoralized by the criticism that you receive. That's not to say that we shouldn't be willing and able to accept responsibility where we have made mistakes, for our failures, for our shortcomings, for our vulnerabilities in what we do. But you have to be realistic, and this goes for all leadership, actually, not just the leadership of a bishop or anybody in leadership, any clergy person. I would often say this: when you have a dog collar wrapped around your neck, people will project onto you all sorts of unrealistic expectations, vast majority of which may well come from their own internal insecurities rather than your actions. I think that's an important perspective to hold on to and to remember. Find a way forward which has integrity and is authentic within the between those two poles is quite important.
So you took early retirement for ill health. Can you tell us a bit about that journey?
Most people look at me and think, oh, he looks as healthy as anybody in the Church of England. I've got one of those.
Well, that's not a great comparison, to be fair. More healthy than them, so I think.
I'd suffered from migraines for about 15 years or something. I'd been getting progressively worse to the extent that by about 2017, I was getting a 48-hour migraine every 8 to 10 days, and it was pretty debilitating to experience it. But my mum and dad, my dad fought in the war. My mum was a nurse in the Blitz, and they were of the generation that brought their children up to say, "You'll cope. You can cope." And I did. I coped with this. I worked through it. I didn't let it stop me working in any way. But I was finding it increasingly difficult to cope with it. And by the time I'd got, that was about 5 years ago now, members of my family were saying to me, "You need to stop, actually. You can't go on killing yourself like this." I was under the National Migraine Clinic, so I was on a drugs treatment. I had my drugs changed. And I suppose this was the thing I always look back to. In the start of 2017, I had my medication changed. And for around about 4 or 5 months, I thought they had found the miracle cure that I had been hoping and looking for the years leading up to it. I found that if I could sense a migraine coming on and I hit it with high doses of this medication, it would ease it off rather than it coming on and being totally debilitated. So for those few months, I was on cloud nine, thinking that this was going to sort out my migraines and allow me to be able to live with them much more easily. And in the middle of that year, 2017, for the first time in my life, I started to experience mental ill health. Everybody goes through ups and downs, don't they? And I don't like to use the word depression. And I found it very hard to even attach the word depression to what I experienced because of that. Mm. But it became clear to me that over the ensuing 6 months that I was in the grip of a quite significant deep depression and acute anxiety. Mm. And I put it down to the fact I'd been asked by the Archbishop of Canterbury to chair this National Commission on Cathedrals, and it was a bit of a poison chalice of a job, if I'm honest. You knew that was, you were never going to be able to get it right for everybody. And I put it down to the fact that there was quite a lot of stress associated with that piece of work. But I got to the turn of the year, and it was one of my sons, actually, my youngest son, who'd done a psychology degree some years earlier, said to me, "Dad, have you ever considered that it might be your migraine medication which is making you mentally unwell?" Mm. And it just hadn't occurred to me. And I look back now and I feel ridiculous. I know enough about these things to know that changes in medication can have an impact on mental health, but it just had not occurred to me. And so there I was, probably in the best place with my migraines for some time, but feeling in an absolutely awful place in terms of my mind. So to cut a long story short, I've discovered that the medication could, in about 1 in 3 situations, cause mental ill health, cause depression and acute anxiety. So I took myself off that medication straight away. And over the course of the next 6 months, I reached a much better place in terms of my mental health. I look back and I think that was the cause of this. But my migraines came back with an absolute vengeance and were deeper and more intense than they had ever been. I said openly then, I'll say it now, I'd rather have a migraine than that depression and acute anxiety, because I felt like I was standing on the edge of an abyss and about to fall into it. And it was an awful place to be. And it gave me a great insight into what people experience when they are mentally unwell. And so in some ways, that's a good thing that I had that insight. I don't think I'd really fully appreciated just how awful it could be to be in that place. I got to the point where I felt the only thing I hadn't attempted to do in any of this was to step back and see if part of the reason, part of the cause of my migraines was the fact that I was working in a very intense environment and doing quite an intense role in the life of the church. My intention was, I'd just turning 60 at the time, and I wasn't intending to retire or stop. I just thought, well, I know I have to resign as bishop because what I'd probably need is a year out just to see what that does to me. So that's what I intended to do. As it transpired, the migraines have carried on pretty much as they were before. So there's clearly something physiological, and it's not just to do with the stress of the job that I was doing. So I now know that I simply have to live with these things.
And you chat about it in a very straightforward way. I mean, that decision to stand down, to be public about your frailty, your physical frailty, having the headaches and stuff, that must have been a tough decision. Did you get backlash? Were people angry at you for stepping down? Or people generally supportive? How did you reconcile yourself to it?
I think if people were angry, they didn't tell me. But the people who told me were people who were supportive and felt it had freed them up to be honest about what they were experiencing. A couple of clergy said to me, I have not even felt able to acknowledge to myself that I'm mentally unwell, but I am able to do that now.
Wow. So you modeled something.
I think there was a certain liberation for some people to feel they did not have to conform to this all-conquering hero
idea of
the clergy. I mean, I suppose I've always tried throughout ministry, I think, to model an appropriate vulnerability. And I mean, that makes it sound as if it's just an intentional thing to do it and not something authentic. What I mean by that is I've tried to be authentic to who I am, and who I am is certainly not some sort of superhero. I'm a very flawed human being, and I think to try and make that as obvious without overplaying it in terms of any situation I've been in, to be honest about my own faults and failings and vulnerabilities and insecurities, I think is part of what the job of ministry is. Actually, to some degree, it felt like an extension of where I'd been. Having said that, and I said this to somebody just yesterday, I do think it's probably the bravest thing I've done in my life to step back. And I don't say that to trumpet it, but, you know, there was an element of courage I had to summon up to do it.
Oh, absolutely. I'm so glad you said that, because I think I want to know more about that. You released other people to be okay with their vulnerability. Because I remember seeing it in the newspaper, Adrian. So I didn't know you really well, but I could see from the photo you were obviously quite a young person and you had this. And I thought, well, this is a really good moment for the church. If somebody's putting their physical and mental health before ministry, I think it must have been a hugely brave decision to do as well. And
in some ways, what you're admitting by saying you're thinking it's courageous is not something very good, is it? Because there's elements of identity and meaning and purpose which are caught up in any role that you do. And by stepping back from that role, particularly when it has an element of hierarchy and symbolic status to it. There's a letting go of that. It's quite possible that you could disintegrate in terms of your identity when you've had such a strongly bound up identity with your role. And I think that's the thing that took a bit of courage, was saying, actually, I will not collapse if I do. I will be me. That the human baptized Christian Adrian is going to survive this. And just because my role is taken away, perhaps actually that will be a good thing, because it will expose who I am to myself and perhaps to others in a way which would not have happened if I'd stayed in role. You know, I've long been drawn by the Irenaean vision of the glory of God being a human being who is fully alive. And I think to be fully alive, you have to embrace all that life and being human is about, don't you? The bad and difficult, challenging things, as well as the good and glorious parts of it.
And some people write and say, and you know, it's actually the tough bits that make us more aware of the glory of life rather than less aware. Absolutely. I think sometimes that's easier in retrospect. I think sometimes when people are ill, there's a pressure, especially with a Christian, to think, oh, it's all fine. I love Jesus. Everything's okay. And not be honest about the experience. But you know, with a healthy honesty about how difficult it can be, you know, that Irenaean vision is very powerful. And even when dying, perhaps as well, that's the goal, isn't it? To have that peace on our final journey.
When you become a bishop, you have to get all sorts of bits of kit, some of which I haven't even got a clue what they were. I don't mind admitting it. You know, what's a rotchet? What's a shamir? I've never heard of these things. but one of the bits of kit you have to get, of course, is a pectoral cross. And lots of bishops use that as a way of trying to identify themselves and to others the nature of the type of ministry they're wanting to have as a bishop. And so I deliberately chose, almost as an emblem for me, which I put it on my pectoral cross, I put it on my my ring, I put it on my mitre as well, the Canterbury cross, which you may or may not know, it's a circular cross, a Canterbury cross, named after a cross which was discovered in a field in Canterbury in the 9th century or something. But it's circular, but it's 8 segmented, this Canterbury cross, and the number 8 is pretty crucial in scriptural terms, and particularly in the book of Revelation. So it's the perfect number, 7 + 1. And so in the number 8 came to be known as the number of resurrection. So it was, you know, the seventh day plus one. And therefore, this 8 segmented cross, the Canterbury cross, is clearly a cross, and it holds within it the cross on which Christ died. It embraces pain and suffering and death, but it also speaks of resurrection. And I've always found that a very moving idea, that the idea that in every little death and every big death that we experience, there are the seeds of resurrection, if we can only find them, if we can only look for them, if we can only excavate them from that experience. And so I think there's something about realistically working our way through the hardest things in life, but looking for the empty tomb, looking for the point of resurrection, looking for the way in which this can lead to renewal and new life and something positive and hopeful for the future as well.
And thinking about your own life and your call, your vocation to ministry, which led to senior position in the church with a mitre and a pectoral cross, I'm sure the non-Anglo-Catholics are now looking that up. You know, how do you think of vocation now? You've retired, and I know you do a host of other things well, but tell me more about that.
No, I'm still trying to work out what vocation means in retirement, if I'm really honest. Fascinating. Actually, you reach this point, I have discovered hardly anything written about vocation in retirement, or even about retirement in general, other than the practical stuff about, well, what do you do about housing and money and all of that, and how do you go about getting a license from the bishop where you are now. So I've done quite a bit of thinking about this myself over the past few years. And I suppose the two words I have been playing around with in my mind that I think have got quite a lot to them. One is decomposing, and the other is rewilding. And the decomposition bit is, until we moved here, I'd never lived in the country in my life. And we don't have a garden where we live. We have no land around this little cottage. And on the eve of lockdown, we managed to acquire half an allotment in the neighbouring village. And so I've been learning quite a lot about the land and gardening and horticulture and stuff like that over the past few years. And one of the things that has fascinated me is the idea of compost. And this will be very familiar to lots of people. It wasn't familiar to me, the idea that you can take things which are ostensibly dead or worthless or have been cut off, and you put them onto this compost heap and you leave them, and what happens is it turns into this fecund, fertile place which gives an extraordinary amount of life back to the land. And so that idea of decomposition, I think, is quite an interesting one to somebody in retirement. Physically, of course, we're at an age where we are decomposing, but actually, having spent a lifetime in ministry of composing, being the one who composed things and made things happen, suddenly I find that my life is really one of decomposition now. And rather than that being solely bad and difficult and diminishing thing, actually to look for what there is in that that can be fecund and fertile and lead to new life and new opportunities. So that's one concept that I think I'm wanting to continue to think about: the vocation of decomposition. What does a vocation to decompose look like when you move from active ministry into retirement? And alongside that, the whole question of rewilding, which, as you all know, is a very significant feature of our environmental landscape at the moment. But again, this idea that once you stop controlling an environment, something new can emerge, which is unexpected, wholly unexpected, and can be far more life-giving than what was there before. And I think there's undoubtedly an element of what I'm trying to do at the moment, which is to stop being in control of my life and stop managing it and just see what happens when I allow a little bit of wild growth to happen, because something unexpected may spring up which I have not seen before and which might surprise me and delight me.
Well, Adrian, it sounds like you need to write that book. I mean, I think quickly before we get release the podcast, I think that's really powerful images. What you described there sounds like a deeply healing journey. Rethinking your vocation in terms of decomposition and rewilding sounds like a way of healing.
I mean, it's work in progress. I'm far from saying I am there or that I've understood where this is going. But then that's part of the excitement and the adventure of it, actually. It's like I don't quite know where it is going to go.
Has your views about health changed? What role has your faith played in your healing journey? You know, you're a man of God. You stand up and tell everyone that we can be reconciled to God through faith in Jesus Christ. There is a particular healing ministry in the church, and yet you haven't been healed, in inverted commas. You still get the headaches. How do you sew all that together?
With difficulty. I don't think that's an easy thing to sew together. But I guess throughout the whole of the ministry that I've pursued, the question of what healing is has always been there. What does healing mean for an individual, particularly somebody who doesn't appear to be physically healed? And what does that mean? Can somebody still be healed and experience healing, even if they don't experience that healing in the way that they hope they might? But also the healing of society. I mean, some sort of collective understanding of this as well. What does it mean for society to be healthy? And of course, those two things are intimately related, as is pretty obvious. I mean, we think of ill health as being pain, limitation of some description. But I suppose when I think of ill health, and in my own experience, the thing that I am aware, I think it's most difficult, is a form of introspection. Ill health turns you in on yourself. It narrows life down. The walls start moving towards you horribly when you're unwell. And that's the nature of it, as something highly introspective and narrowing life around you can be one of the most difficult aspects of ill health. And I don't think you can escape the first things I listed there, the pain and the limitation and the anguish. I think they, unless you are fortunate enough to have a very obvious physical healing, I don't think you can escape those things. But you can, it seems to me, do an awful lot about the introspection. And I suppose in my mind, I think of health as sort of heads up living, as living, looking outwards, continuing to look outwards, even if you are in pain, even if you experience limitations because of ill health, retaining the ability to look upwards and outwards to God and to neighbor. That, I think, is probably how I would understand good health these days.
That's so powerful, because it's talking there about connection, isn't it? Still connected to the world, still connected, and still seeking. If your head's up, you're seeking, aren't you? And there's such pressure. I'm sure it's always been like this in some ways, but pressure today, when you say health, you think of that magazine rack, don't you? Or I do anyway. I don't know if you buy magazines, but you know, the health, you know, it's all about perfection, about eating well, which actually implies some kind of economic ability to do so, and perfect bodies and beauty. And it's actually about pressure to perform in some way or to be seen as in some way. Whereas actually what you've described is how to live. And how to work out who you are.
It struck me when you were speaking that two things which you might associate with health are things that I do a lot of. So I've moved to a plant-based diet over the past few years, and I do an awful lot of exercise on my bike around the flatlands and hills of Essex. But I did not even think of those things when you asked me to think about health, whereas both of those things could be understood as being the things that make us healthy: eat a good diet, take lots of exercise. I suppose it's because I feel that health is something much more profound than that. Those things are maybe part of it, and they might help you to have a healthy outlook, but it's something deeper than that, it seems to me.
There's an amazing quotation. It's Maltman, I think. He defines health as the power to live and the power to die, which I just think, wow, that's it. Because the problem with that magazine rack, and there's nothing wrong with plant-based diet or any exercise, of course, is that the health industry never mentions death. And the medical system is, you know, largely based on avoiding it at all costs. So it's like this massive elephant in the room anytime most people talk about health. And it's the massive elephant that the church and the faith in Jesus Christ can address.
It sort of is back to the Canterbury Cross. It's the death and resurrection being held together, needing to be able to cope with both of those. I do a little bit of leading of services and preaching still when I'm asked to around here. And I was asked to do Easter and this year, and I was preaching on the stone rolled away from the tomb and making the point that, well, why was the stone rolled away from the tomb? Well, there was absolutely no reason from Jesus' point of view for it to be rolled away from the tomb. It's pretty clear that after his resurrection, he can move through walls and doors and, you know, teletransport across all sorts of distances. So he didn't need the stone to be moved to get out of the tomb. So it must have been moved for our benefit, for us to look in, because we are being called to look in and to realize that the tomb is empty, and then to go out and live the rest of our lives in that full recognition that we live as people of resurrection in a world where resurrection is a reality. And so I think there is something very significant about that in terms of how we think about our lives.
Yeah. I've never thought about why the stone was rolled away. So you've just written my next Easter sermon and everyone listening. Brilliant. I never thought about it. That's so wonderful about the Gospels and the Bible. You can go back and see something new every single time. And I just think it's such an important message for what people are going through today. We're facing vast social trauma, which has shaken the foundations of so much we sort of have taken for granted as a society, and exposed so many wounds of injustice and so on, that never has this message of needing to spot the glimmer of the resurrection in life more important. When it's tough, Adrian, when you're, you know, maybe when the headaches are back or when you're having a tough time, in terms of the faith, what helps? And I'm asking the question, you know, for anyone who's listening who is struggling to see that glimmer of the resurrection today.
I think sometimes it's having some markers on your journey that to hold on to. And I do think a commitment to things like asking, where is the gift in this? We are all going to experience all manner of challenging issues in life. It might be physical illness. It might be something very, very different. It might be the breakdown of a relationship, whatever it might be. And to hold as a sort of spiritual marker that you are always going to ask that question of God and deeply of yourself, where is the gift in this? What gift am I being given in this? It is a way of lifting, you know, that heads up living that I think health is about, trying to look away from the interior journey as the soul defining pilgrimage that you are going through, and to try and discover gift is important. And When we think about contemplating the empty tomb, I think that's what, again, one of the things that we're doing is we're saying, where is the resurrection in this death? So I think asking those questions and almost laying those down as whatever I go through, I am going to do this. I mean, how do people do that practically? For me, I will often walk and ask those questions of myself. Other people may find it easier to sit inside and do that and to sort of kneel down and pray in their sacred place. But for me, I find it easier to sit on the saddle of my bike or to get my walking boots on and to go out and to ask those questions. Having important people around you, people who can share the journey. I mean, that's one of the things I think we all would say, that to have one or two people like that who can be soul friends to you when the going is difficult and when you're finding it difficult to get perspective. It's so important to have people who can help you think it through, who can help talk it through, or who can simply sit with you and just acknowledge the fact that it's tough, that's the problem shared stuff, isn't it? Whether it becomes a problem halved, I don't know, but I think a problem that's shared certainly becomes a lighter burden to carry. And sometimes I think it's the discipline stuff, isn't it? It's the keep on doing the right things, whether that's, you know, prayer and worship, whether it's doing the things that you know are good for you. It's very easy, isn't it? I mean, although we talked about sort of eating healthily and exercising, if you start to live introspectively and find the walls of life closing in around you, the first thing that happens is you start to eat badly and then you start not to move anywhere. And both of those things have a profound impact on our minds. they make us think badly. And our minds are the powerful element to our existence. And we have to be as careful as we can about feeding them well, and looking after our minds to try and avoid them making an already tough situation tougher.
Oh, thank you. So wise as well, because we are a mind, body, spirit. We are, you know, science has proved it. So does the Hebrew Bible, by the way. It's so important to look after our bodies and minds. And there's something really healing about being outdoors. I was having a very tough time the other week, and I realized I'd been inside or doing the children's school run for days. And I just went outside and I felt better. I just did not need a roof over my head. It was really weird. Bishop Adrian Newman, thank you so much. Talking about gift, it's been a gift to talk with you. Thank you so much for sharing your experience, the good bits and the bad bits of leadership, of living with ill health. Thank you so much for modeling something really profound about looking up about health when things aren't always so rosy.
Thank you. I've enjoyed having the chat, and I thank you for all that you're doing with your work, and with particularly with these hubs, which I think could be a real gift to the church.
Thank you so much.
So that was my conversation with Bishop Adrian. Thank you so much for listening. What did you think? You know, it was wonderful to just spend time with Adrian. I felt like he had something I needed, that in his decision to leave the church, his honesty about his mental health struggle, his ongoing living with pain at such regular intervals, there was some real embodied spiritual wisdom for us all there. We'd love to know what you thought of the podcast. The podcast is freely available to all, but we pick up the conversation in the Go Health community. If you're not already a member, join us. It's only £4 a month. You get resource bundles, you get discounts, you get free events, you get free training, all sorts of things going on in the Go Health community. Our tagline is wonderful. It is together we flourish. Together we flourish. And that's what we try to do through resources, events, conversations. Together we flourish for our good and for the good of the communities we live in the name of God. And right now, I'm so excited. We are booking for our first ever Go Health community gathering, a retreat in the Lake District in the north of England, where we can keep the conversation going. Keep working out how to flourish together. Let's chat, let's engage, let's connect with one another over meals, over walks and campfires. I'm very excited about the campfires. It's called the Wilderness and Wellbeing Retreat. It's a 2-night retreat, and we are focusing on the healing power of where we are, the Lake District, the beauty of nature, and use it to explore the Christian faith and to reflect on our spiritual journey. And we have booked two fantastic leaders, specialists in mountain spirituality, in walking and pilgrimage. It's taking place on the 16th to the 18th of September. Head over to the website for more details or check out the episode notes to find out more. Please rate and subscribe. Hit the subscribe button, right? Why not share it on your social medias too? We want as many people as possible to experience these conversations and to connect into our work. That would be amazing. So in the meantime, and for the last time in season 2, God bless you. Let's keep connecting and chatting. Let's keep learning to heal, because together we flourish.